work elites.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming at you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest, and the views of our guest for the first hour is going to be Mr. William Grigg. And Mr. Grigg was for many years a senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, he's writing you can go to his blog there at rightsource.com and get the material he's coming up with. He's doing talk radio and writing and has a new book coming out. And it's always a pleasure to have William with us because he has very insightful comments on what's really going on in the world today. William, thank you very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, as always, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, tell me, what do you think the major issues are? What would you like to talk about tonight?
A couple of things that have been in the news recently I think are really indicative of some disturbing trends. I discussed earlier with you this week the Larry Craig imbroglio, which just gets nastier with every passing day. And there are some elements of that that I think are worthy of further remark. But one thing I wanted to mention right off the bat was the story in this morning's WorldNet Daily by Jerome Corsi about the civilian prison facilities that have been authorized for creation, construction, and occupation on U.S. military facilities. He points out that he was researching some other issue and he came across a regulation that was promulgated a couple of years ago, February 14, 2005, entitled Installation Civilian Inmate Labor Camps. About 10 years ago, there was some controversy over a regulation that had been issued under the Clinton administration for civilian inmate labor camps on military facilities. And this is something that had been revised just 2 years ago, a little more than 2.5 years ago. And the regulation, according to Corsi, specifies the Army's primary purpose for allowing establishment of prison camps on Army installations is to use the resident nonviolent civilian inmate labor pool to work on the leased portions of the installation. And it goes on to explain that the chief purpose of using this nonviolent civilian inmate labor pool is such purposes as constructing or repairing roads, cleaning, maintaining, reforesting public lands, building levees, and constructing or repairing any other public ways or works financed wholly or in major part by funds appropriated by Congress. And the regulation that Corsi is talking about here limits this program to using inmates from facilities under the control of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And the chief benefit is that the Army has a source of labor at no direct cost to Army installations to accomplish tasks that would not be possible otherwise due to the manning and funding constraints under which the Army operates. Dr. Stanley, I think what's happening here, and this is something that I had discussed earlier today in another interview, is we're seeing, in principle, the germ of an American logi system. You're probably acquainted with the communist Chinese logi labor camp system, which is operated by their military, the so-called People's Liberation Army. And Harry Wu and some others who have researched this issue, Mr. Wu, of course, was an inmate of the logi, or reformed through labor camps in China, pointed out that this is a source of revenue in manufacturing for the PLA in its business operations. And I think we might be seeing the embryonic stage of a similar system here in the United States, which is very troubling, to say the least.
Well, of course, the thing is that right at the present time, this has not been invoked. But the thing is that why would they have this legislation or these regulations unless they were planning on doing something
exactly
like this? In other words, down the line, just as in many other countries, they would put people into camps and use them for labor and labor purposes.
It's not well understood in this country that the United States has the largest prison population of any country on earth, including communist China.
You know, I think that's really so strange. We have over 7 million people in the United States and either in prison or probation or parole.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these people are there simply, well, some of them are there because they were government employees who wanted to tell the public what was really going on, and they were put into prison. There's a wonderful book. In fact, there's two of them we carry, written by Rodney Stitch.
Mm-hmm.
One's Defrauding America, the other's Drugging America, about the people he met when he was in prison on trumped-up charges who were formerly working with the DEA or the FBI or the CIA or other government agencies, and they were sent to prison in an effort to silence them. People say that couldn't happen here. Well, I would suggest they simply check out Rodney Stitch's material and get some of the material I have, and I'm sure that you have as well, that yes, sometimes people are put in prison to silence them. People say that could not happen in America. Well, if we really have 7 million people in prison, probation or parole here in the United States, why is that never talked about? As you said, that most people are totally unaware of that.
Yeah, we have a larger prison population in absolute terms, not in proportionate terms, but in absolute terms, than the prison population in communist China. And the entire population of the United States is roughly 300 million. That's a rounding error when trying to calculate the population of China. And yet we have a larger prison population than what you find in an avowedly communist-run country. And the other aspect of this that I find really interesting is that you've got to think that apart from the people who are unambiguous political prisoners, which is to say people who have been sent to prison on trumped up or entirely confected charges as a type of retribution for an act of whistleblowing or somehow otherwise making life difficult for the political establishment. Apart from those people, you also have a large nonviolent inmate population, people who have not committed crimes of violence against persons or committed crimes of property destruction. And I'm of the belief, and some people don't see things exactly the way I do, but I'm of the belief that really the only reason why somebody should be sent to prison would be an offense against persons or property. If you're dealing with offenses against public order, that should be something that should be handled at the local level, and that would, of course, reflect the values of a given community. I don't think really you should have a whole lot of crimes that don't involve some kind of an offense against other people. And
hold that thought right there, please. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We were just talking about the tremendous prison population we have here in America, and William was just saying we've got an awful lot of people in prison who have not committed acts of violence at all, and if they certainly there may be crimes that they've committed, but will we really benefit by putting them in prison? Is there other ways of dealing with this, without actually putting... Sometimes I think maybe prison is a good lesson for people.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we have a prison population this large that all across America, there simply are not enough beds in the prisons for the population there. Here in California, they're having to actually take people out of our state prisons and ship them to other states.
Yeah, like Idaho, where I live.
Right. And in fact, there was recently a very well-known Hollywood starlet, you know, who was sent to prison. I think he was supposed to be there 14 days or something. They kept her there for 82 minutes and immediately released her. Why? Because there just wasn't any room in the prisons.
Sure. And because it was considered to be a better use of that particular resource to lock up somebody who had actually done something to imperil or injure the rights of other people, as opposed to somebody who is guilty of, if I remember correctly, you're dealing with something that was a nonviolent offense of I believe it was a traffic violation or something.
No, actually, but she was a recurrent drunk driving,
yeah.
using drugs. So she was driving
with
the wrong way. Wrong way. Now, the freeway, personally, I think that she needs a good spanking, something of the sort.
That would probably
she needs
be
to be disciplined very, very
more
severely.
Useful sanction, yeah. But the thing about the inmate population we're describing here is that I think there's a perverse incentive being created for the promulgation of criminal statutes that result in the wide-scale incarceration of people who are not criminals in the conventional sense, meaning people who steal, people who assault others or threaten them with assault, people, in other words, who are an active violent menace to others. Those are criminals by any definition. But we're talking about people, for instance, who might have been involved in the consumption of narcotics, which is a terrible thing to do, but it's not a violent crime. And that, if I'm not mistaken, is probably the single largest source of the nonviolent inmate population in our prisons right now. But beyond the question of whether that's the sort of thing that is best treated in that fashion, the fact remains that under our Constitution, there's only supposed to be, if I remember correctly, one federal crime. And that crime, if I remember correctly, is treason. And we don't have 7 million people who've been convicted of treason on the evidence of multiple witnesses and so forth. And so really, when you have a federal prison population that big, you've got to think that that reflects some real serious distortions in the legal system, the justice system. And now you have a situation where an inmate population can be used to carry out manual labor for the military, and that means, in practice, that they're going to be carrying out manual labor on behalf of the quasi-private corporatist contractors who are becoming a bigger, ever increasingly bigger, portion of the military-industrial complex. And one of the major contractors, Halliburton subsidiary KBR, is doing what? They're building prisons. They're building detention facilities, supposedly to house illegal aliens, but I believe that the actual purpose would be to house the larger prison population. And so you have sort of a self-sustaining cycle here. I suspect what's going to happen is you're going to have the military and KBR using civilian labor, civilian inmate labor, to build these prisons that are going to sit there and presumably wait to be filled with others. And so I think all of this points to an anticipation on the part of the government, the people who run the government, that there's going to be a lot of business for the prison system in coming years. And I don't think it's because we've got a growing population of miscreants and malefactors. I think it's because there is going to be an upheaval in this country as the economy worsens, or perhaps as the dollar collapses and the economy implodes. You know, everything is in place right now for a full-scale garrison state, and that would mean you'd have a lot of prison space that would have to be filled up. What better way to build those prisons than to have the military being involved, herding these civilian inmates around like so many chattel slaves to build the prisons that would house presumably the rest of us if things keep going the way they're going right now? I hate to sound like somebody who's a screeching alarmist, but given what we're seeing unfold in front of us right now, that's a possibility we really ought to give some sober and serious consideration to.
Well, I will tell you what, you might pull down the actual federal regulations there for, you know, for civilian use in military camps. In other words, a civilian labor force controlled by the military. And it's really rather frightening. It is available from Radio Liberty and probably some slight charge because it's fairly long, 30 or 40 pages. But it's important that people understand this is not imaginary. It's really very real. If anybody has any question, we have a video clip. It's called The Sampler. And there you'll actually hear Congressman Henry Gonzalez, longtime Democratic congressman and certainly a longtime chairman of the House Banking Committee, saying, yes, there really is a plan in case of a national disturbance in this country to suspend the Constitution and round up Americans and put them into detention camps. And of course, in that same clip, you'll actually see Congressman Jack Brooks trying to bring this out at a congressional hearing, an Iran-Contra hearing, and being repeatedly interrupted by a senator in a way who doesn't want the American people to know about this plan. And, of course, it involved Oliver North. It was a plan during the Reagan administration. And you'll actually see this on the CNN clip there. That's called the sampler, if anybody wants to see it. But, of course, they do not want the American people to know. And this is what's so concerning to me, is that everything is being kept from the American people. Keep them fat, dumb, and happy until until it's too late, like it was in Hitler's Germany. And this, of course, is really a vehicle used by people who want cheap labor. And this is what they used in Germany. They used it for building war equipment, for building the rockets. They simply conscripted people and put them into concentration camps. And those who could work, worked in the factories. And those who couldn't, well, they had Auschwitz and Buchenwald and Dachau and similar places to send them.
Well, and a more contemporary example, as we mentioned before the break, was what's going on in China with the Logai, so-called educator reform through labor camps. The idea being that if you run afoul of the myriad regulations and ordinances and laws that have been propagated by the government in Beijing, it's very easy to do because it is a communist regime. They claim jurisdiction over everything. If you run afoul of any of those, you can end up in the reform through labor camp, and they're particularly interested in imprisoning Christians who don't belong to any of the state-authorized modes of worship. If they're not part of the patriotic Catholic Church, which takes its direction from Beijing rather than from Rome, or the Three Self Protestant movement, which is likewise a concubine of the regime in Beijing, or the Muslim or Buddhist or other religious equivalents. If you, for instance, have a house church, if you're somebody who's an unaligned, non-official, unrecognized Christian pastor, and you have your own congregation, chances are you're going to attract the interest of the regime. You'll probably end up in one of these camps. And the idea is that once you're there, you have to engage in thought reform so as to recognize your necessity of making yourself subordinate to your masters in the Communist Party of China, but also you're building things which are used to enrich the corporatist ventures which are owned and operated by the people who run the People's Liberation Army, the so-called princeling class over in China. And I think what we're seeing right now is the emergence of a similar system. You have to make allowances, of course, for cultural distinctions between China and the United States. But you take a look at this whole constellation of really corrupt corporate interests that have clustered around the Bush administration. I mean, Dick Cheney is paradigmatic of this particular breed of politicized capitalist. He's somebody who has never had an honest job in the private sector. He shares that with people like Bill Clinton, for instance. Dick Cheney, apart from, I think, one summer he worked on an oil rig in Wyoming, has always been working in politics somehow. And after being the Secretary of Defense under the first Bush administration, he became the CEO of Halliburton, the oil service conglomerate. And in that capacity, he got all kinds of subsidies from the Export-Import Bank and the Overseas Private Investment Corporation and other entities that supply taxpayer funds to conduct this socialized, subsidized, transnational so-called capitalism, and that entailed, among other things, building up the nuclear capacity in Iran, which I think is interesting. Now Dick Cheney is beating the drums for a war with Iran because of a nuclear capacity his Halliburton Corporation helped to build up, as well as building nuclear power plants in places like China, once again subsidized by American taxpayers. And Halliburton's been involved, along with affiliates, in supplying materiel and support services for the military in various ventures, whether you're talking about what happened in the Balkans. They were deeply involved, for instance, in providing material support for the expeditionary force in Bosnia and also in Kosovo. They helped build Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, which is this huge, ultra-modern, self-contained permanent base of the sort that you're seeing built in Iraq. They're building a whole archipelago of permanent bases in Iraq. And this is all being done by Halliburton, KBR, and DynCorp, and a whole menagerie of these corporations. But these are people who have made their profits not through risk-taking and innovation, but through politics. They've cuddled up to the power elite, done its bidding, and been rewarded with lavish sinecures and subsidies and market concessions. And now we're seeing this inmate labor program that's probably going to end up benefiting a lot of these people that are connected to the military-industrial complex. Perfectly abhorrent.
It really is, and if anybody really doubts that these regulations do exist, you can check that WorldNet Daily story, and I'm sure that William has material on his website, and we actually have the regulation available through Radio Liberty. If you need it, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927.
When we're talking about this, for lack of a better way of describing it, princeling class of American politicized capitalists, it's useful to point out that there's a really interesting...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that will protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
defaulting on his loans, I would simply point out that your tax money has built the infrastructure of Russia, the gas wells, the oil wells have been built with money coming from you, from the Export-Import Bank, from the certainly the World Bank, from the American corporations, the International Monetary Fund, the Asian Development Bank. And if you doubt all of that, you can go to my website at RadioLiberty.com and read my newsletters of March, April, May, and June, or we can get them together in a little pamphlet called the Communist-Capitalist Alignment, Alliance, Communist-Capitalist Alliance, a term used by Solzhenitsyn, who recognized the fact that the tyranny in Russia was always financed from America. So
yeah,
people need to understand that. And then, of course, William was simply talking about how there are people here in this country who always want to have an enemy. And our current enemy, well, our current enemy is terrorism and Iran, but of course Russia is coming back as an enemy. And the more enemies we have, the more control the government has to have over the people here to protect us from those wicked enemies.
You know, the really interesting thing about this instant enemy, enemy of the week type of approach to what we have to call perception management or even population management is that you find some people who've made a very handsome living off of anti-communism who have become very close to some of the worst elements of the so-called ex-KGB over in Russia. I mean, a really good example, that's Jack Abramoff. About a year and a half ago, I did a cover story for The New American, and unfortunately, that's the last significant work of investigative journalism they've done there. They've got the best investigative journalist in the country as their senior editor, Bill Jasper. I wish they'd let him off his leash and let him tear into some big subjects, because there's plenty to write about. They've just shifted their priorities over there editorially, which is a tragedy. As, you know, free Bill Jasper, you know, let Bill loose. That's what I've been hoping they'll do. In any case, Jack Abramoff is somebody who was an enterprising anti-communist in the 1980s. But one of the things that came out in the Abramoff scandals, which people have almost completely forgotten about, these bribery and corruption scandals where Abramoff and his lobbyists were lavishing these huge bribes on a number of people, primarily in the Republican Party, but a few on the other side of the aisle, such as Senator Reid from Nevada, is that he was very tight with some people in Russia who are involved in the energy sector and whose background is in the KGB and the GRU, the military intelligence agency of the former Soviet Union. And some of the people he worked with are really, really nasty folks. And this is a guy who in the 1980s, as late as 1988-89, was involved in these big anti-communist conferences in places like Africa. He actually put together the money and financed an action film called Red Scorpion, which was something of an embarrassment artistically, but it was, to the best of my knowledge, apart from the third Rambo film, the only film made about the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, which was a pretty horrible thing. I mean, there were things going on involving the booby trapping of landmines to look like children's toys and the use of chemical weapons. Just really horrible things that the Red Army did to Afghanistan. And Abramoff made a movie about that in 1988. It debuted in 1989, and then, you know, 10 years later, a little more than 10 years later, suddenly this guy is working with the KGB. And you had an instance where Tom DeLay, the former majority leader, you know, the Republican whip and then majority whip in the Republican-dominated House of Representatives, went to Russia as the guest of these same people who were involved in the, what you'd have to call the KGB, Russian mafia-dominated energy sector in Russia. And so, really, when you look at it from that perspective, it's not so much that we have an enemy here as we see sort of a type of collaboration, cynical collaboration, almost by way of stage management or stagecraft, like a professional wrestling match where two guys go at each other in the ring for an hour, and then afterwards, you see them driving off in the same car, they go to the same bar and have a beer together.
It's sort of like Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, Amos and Andy. It's great showbiz, but the
exactly.
truth of the matter is we've funded, and people here in America have funded, Russia Since Its Very Inception, beautifully covered by Professor Anthony Sutton in his book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. My interview with Professor Sutton before he passed away, we call it The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. Things are never what they appear to be. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Let's get back to our special guest this evening, Mr. William Grigg. Go ahead, William.
It's interesting you bring up this idea of the best enemy that money can buy. You go back to the mid-1980s when we had the Iran-Iraq war raging. That was a war that killed millions of people, and it got very little attention here in the West, in large measure because you had two pretty unappetizing regimes tilting at each other. The Iran-Iraq war, began when Iraq opportunistically invaded Iran. They were the aggressor, and Iraq never managed to do what it set out to achieve, which was to make Iran accept dictation regarding some territorial issues and some resource issues. They managed to lose the war that they started. That's one of the reasons why in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I was sort of perplexed that they were treating Saddam Hussein as if he were some kind of a world historic military menace, because I said, well, didn't he start the war with Iran? Didn't he lose the war with Iran? And it was really quite a feat of incompetence there, because of course at the time Iran had gone through a revolution. It was still very unstable. It was under several varieties of sanctions because of things that had been done, including the kidnapping of American hostages and holding them for 444 days. And Iraq was being supported by both the United States and Russia, Soviet Russia at the time. And in spite of that, it managed to lose its war with Iran. But you can go back to 1986, actually I believe it was 1987, which was the year that an Iraqi Exocet missile hit the USS Stark, which it was an attack at a time when the United States and the Soviet Union, once again, were jointly conducting a naval exercise in the Persian Gulf to protect U.S.-flagged Kuwaiti oil vessels. The Iraqis attacked the USS Stark with an Exocet missile, killing 37 American servicemen aboard that vessel, and the Reagan administration found a way to blame Iran for that, which I thought was just astonishing. I mean, it was Iraq that fired the missile. It was an Iraqi-purchased missile that killed American sailors. But the thing that I find interesting is that back in 1987, if you go back and look at a cover story that appeared, I think, in May of that year in the New Republic magazine, there was an article entitled Back Iraq, and it was written by Richard Perle and Lori Milroy. Now, those two names don't mean a lot to a lot of people, but Richard Perle is one of the great eminences behind the current war on Iraq.
And so is Lori Milroy.
Yeah, Lori Milroy is somebody who, for at least 15 years, has been promoting the idea, well, not 15, it would have been 14 years, has been promoting the idea that Saddam was behind the 1993 attack on the World Trade.
Hold on. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about the fact that it's very strange that certainly in the 1987 period, why a man named William Perle and a woman named Lori Milroy were writing articles, saying back Iraq, and yet, a few years later, they were the major architects of the war on Iraq. Of course, they both come from the American Enterprise Institute, which is the neocon think tank, which is really controlling the Bush administration's policies, mm-hmm. and almost everything that the Bush administration has done, in the last 6-7 years, has all been dictated by people coming from there. One time, one minute they're backing Iraq, the next minute they want to attack Iraq. But
yeah.
Go right ahead, William.
Yeah, well, and we end up getting jerked around both ways. But the thing about this article by Richard Perle and Lori Milroy is that almost exactly 20 years later, you've got the same people talking about backing the Sunni element of the multifarious civil war that's emerging in Iraq. And the Sunni element, of course, would be dominated by the Ba'ath Party or by remnants of the Ba'ath Party, which was Saddam Hussein's ruling elite. You can go back to the late 1980s, and once again, Lloyd Milroy, who has become sort of the chief proponent of the idea that Saddam Hussein was behind the 1993 World Trade Center attack, behind the 1995 attack on the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City, and behind the 2001 9/11 attack. He's been promoting those ideas assiduously for a number of years. But back in the late 1980s, she actually wrote an essay for Orbis, which is a number of these neocon, neo-Trotskyite intellectual journals. There was a hymn to Saddam Hussein's Iraq, talking about what a wonderful secular progressive country it was, and how, unlike in most of the Middle East, you had an element of women's liberation. You had women wearing skirts shorter in Baghdad than people were wearing in Boston, was one of the things she said. And how Saddam, for all of his apparent brutality, was somebody who was actually creating a glorious little haven of enlightenment values and views there in Baghdad. This is somebody just a few years later would pivot 180 degrees and start talking about how Saddam Hussein was the modern avatar of Adolf Hitler, and how he posed a existential threat to the West, and she's been on that hobby horse now for about 10 or 15 years. I suspect it's because the people who are paying her sinecure, paying for her position with the AEI, have just dictated to her a different party line. And so, as the situation was described in Orwell's 1984, suddenly, instead of being at war with Eurasia, we're at war with East Asia. We've always been at war with East Asia. And Eurasia has always been our gallant comrades in the struggle. And the same kind of thing has happened with respect to the prospective war with Iran. A lot of the people who, say, five years ago, back in 2002, were talking about how Saddam Hussein had been defying the world, that he was reconstituting his nuclear weapons. As a matter of fact, Dick Cheney said that in the past tense. He has reconstituted nuclear weapons. That was a claim made by the Vice President of the United States. That same rhetoric is now being applied to Tehran. Suddenly we're hearing that Tehran represents the threat of a new Holocaust. That was what Bush said this week in a speech, I believe, at the VFW. And about 2 or 3 hours after that speech was made, suddenly a group of Iranian electricians were arrested in Iraq. And I think that was a calculated provocation. And we're in a really interesting situation when it is the relative moderation and restraint of the admittedly awful regime in Tehran that is preventing escalation from taking place that would lead to an outright shooting war between the United States and Iran. But all these things reflect what we were talking about earlier, Stan, about the fact that there is this permanent interest on the part of certain people in Washington and New York primarily, as well as places like London, to ensure that we always have an enemy, that we're always involved in some kind of a grand standoff for which the stakes are little less than the future of civilization. Because by doing so, of course, you can get people to suspend their critical thinking and support impositions on their liberties and expenditures, you know, the waste of immense volumes of wealth on programs that are basically the institutionalization of warfare in one form or another. And James Madison put it the best when he said way back in, I believe it was 1793, that no nation can preserve its liberty in the midst of continual warfare. If you're always fighting a war, preparing for a war, or carrying out some kind of a metaphorical war, liberty is the first thing that's going to suffer. And we've reached a point now where it's becoming obvious to people who care about liberty that Madison's insights are being validated in real time all around us.
Well, I share your concerns, and I'm firmly convinced that there are people in Washington, D.C. who want to take America to war with Iran, and everything points that they're just looking for an excuse. They certainly build up the Air Force facilities in the Middle East. They have the carrier forces, strike forces. There is more military power there, you know, in the form of the Navy and Air Force than I believe it probably has ever been accumulated before, and I think they're just waiting for an excuse to go to war with Iran. Chris, they say it's only going to be a 6-day war, going to be a little short war, our boys will be home, and but they don't take into consideration that what happens if Iran were to strike back at our forces, sink one of our ships, kill a few thousand American soldiers, might even have a passing freighter, lob a couple of missiles at New York or Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Then would the war be over in 6 weeks, or would we have to punish them for having not surrendered, you know, without retaliation? Mm-hmm. And the thing is that there are people in Iran who think differently than we do. They would like to have a war. They're almost defying us to get us into a war, and I'm really very, very concerned. How about you?
Well, I'm exceptionally concerned for a number of reasons. I think that if there were a war between the United States and Iran, it would take much longer than 6 weeks, unless it were to go nuclear, in which case we'd be entering really an unprecedented phase in human history. I really don't think that people understand the seriousness of Dick Cheney, for instance, when he has said in so many words that nothing is off the table. When asked about the use of nuclear weapons, both Cheney and Bush have said nothing is off the table. Every single one of the Republican candidates, with one exception, Ron Paul, has endorsed the preemptive use of nuclear weapons against Iran. Several of the Democrat candidates, including Senators Clinton and Obama, have endorsed the use of nuclear weapons against Iran, although they've not been as forthright about a preemptive nuclear strike as the Republicans have been. That's just simple lunacy. But the thing that I find most interesting about what's happening right now is the overt and obvious effort by the Bush administration to tune the atmosphere for a war with Iran and to provoke Tehran into giving them a pretext. There's a recent report from a fellow named Barnett R. Rubin, who's the Director of Studies and Senior Fellow at New York University's Center on International Cooperation. He's somebody who's very much hardwired into the whole neocon network. And what Mr. Rubin is saying is the following, from somebody whom he describes as being very, very close to the administration. They have instructions, yes, that was the word used, from the office of the vice president to roll out a campaign for war with Iran in the week after Labor Day. That will be next week. It will be coordinated with the American Enterprise Institute, there's the AEI connection again, Dr. Stan, the Wall Street Journal, the Weekly Standard, Commentary, Fox, and the usual suspects. It will be heavy, sustained assault on the airwaves designed to knock public sentiment into a position from which a war can be maintained. Evidently, they don't think they'll ever get majority support for this. They want something like 35-40% support, which in their book is plenty. And Mr. Rubin said that he has this from what he describes as, quote, a friend who has excellent connections in Washington and whose information has often been prescient. And this fellow predicts that we can look forward to a big kickoff on September 11th. That wouldn't surprise me at all, because once again, if you take a look at the way that just in the last couple of weeks, the Bush administration has ratcheted up the rhetoric against Iran to the point where you are almost being accused of something akin to Holocaust denial or anti-Semitism if you do not consider Iran to be an active present threat to the Western civilized world. And you're almost in a position now where the Bush administration would designate the chief element of the Iranian military as a terrorist entity, which would give the Bush administration the legal pretext for invoking the September 24, 2001 authorization for use of military force as a declaration of war against Iran. That is an open-ended blank check for the president to decide against whom we would wage a war, which is why I opposed it at the time. And one of the few things that Ron Paul has gotten wrong, he's admitted this, that he's gotten wrong on constitutional grounds, was when he voted for the authorization for use of military force because he considered it to be something of a letter of marque for use to go into Afghanistan and find Osama bin Laden, who'd been accused of carrying out the September 11th attacks. But in hindsight, he says, I never should have voted for that measure because it's tantamount to a self-sustaining, open-ended declaration of war, a blank check for the president to decide against whom would end up going to war. And he's, that is to say, Ron Paul, Representative Paul, has very candidly and I think commendably expressed regret for that vote. But the fact is, unless we repeal that, or unless some other measure is enacted very quickly, the Bush administration is likely going to use that measure from 6 years ago, sometime around September 11th, to start pushing for a military strike against Iran, or to try to engender some kind of an action on the part of that regime that would be taken as a pretext for war. A remember the main type of incident could very easily be engineered when you've got that much military hardware, that many ships in the Persian Gulf. It's almost become, you know, the U.S. Navy's bathtub. You know, something could very easily be arranged. And I honestly think that if we have a war with Iran, it's going to be hard to keep it conventional. It is not well situated for a conventional war involving air power, certainly not involving armor. Iran is composed entirely of hills, just like Afghanistan in that respect. It's very, very difficult to take out their deeply entrenched nuclear facilities unless you're using the type of ordnance that tactical nuclear bunker buster is what's being discussed here. And if you end up using one of those against Iran, once again, that's a huge Rubicon to cross. And there are people who are already looking forward to that, and the public mind is being prepared for that type of a contingency. And God help us if that happens. I mean, what that would mean economically, let alone diplomatically, morally, and militarily, would be very grievous indeed. The oil shock that would result from a war with Iran itself would probably be enough to destroy what remains of our economy. Our economy's headed for tough times anyway. We're seeing a full meltdown. And I just don't know exactly how much longer our economy can sustain the imperial policy that the Bush administration and its neocon handlers have ordained for our country. But if we end up with a war with Iran, that would be quite enough to send us into a depression, I'm pretty sure.
Well, I think the people have never stopped and thought, where would the money come from? Right now we're having to borrow
$3 billion a day.
$2 to $3 billion a day. Some people say $3 billion every day from some other place or from some other country or from the American people just to meet our current debts. We do not have massive reserves. We are the largest debtor nation the world has ever seen. We have, of course, over $800 billion deficit, trade deficit with the world. We have certainly a massive federal deficit, and they'll tell you it's only $211 billion this year. But they're simply lying. It's probably well over $1 trillion if you look at it correctly. And our overall debt, at least according to Dr. Kiplikoff, an economist writing for the St. Louis branch of the Federal Reserve, and anybody can pull that article down off the internet. Is it Kiplikoff? Is that his name?
Yes.
And of course, get it. This is an economist. He'll tell you America is bankrupt. That's the title of the article. Is America bankrupt? Because the real debt is over at least $60 billion, $60 trillion. $60 trillion. We would never be able to pay that off.
No.
In all time.
Well, what's happening right now on that front, and this is all, of course, connected with the other developments that we're talking about here, because we're really the world's first mendicant superpower. I don't think there's ever been an empire before that has built such a huge edifice of control on the basis of money borrowed from foreign rivals. I don't think that's ever happened before in human history, where you have the world's reserve currency being a fiat currency issued by the world's biggest debtor. That's just utterly bizarre. I don't know how that can perpetuate itself. I mean, you're into Lewis Carroll territory here. But when you're talking about what's going on with the economy, it's interesting how something like $1 trillion of liquidity has been pumped into the global economy by central banks here in the United States and Europe and Canada and elsewhere. I mean, the Fed alone has been putting hundreds of billions of dollars out I don't know how many hundreds of billions of dollars, because they do not report the money supply figures anymore the way they used to.
You're talking about this recent effort to salvage the world economy.
Yeah.
And we're talking about within the last two or three weeks.
Yeah.
And I mean, they've just created this money out of nothing.
Yeah.
And highly inflationary. People don't understand that, you know, you cannot keep creating money out of nothing indefinitely. Pretty soon, of course, because every time you create money out of nothing, you lower the value of the currency.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon, your currency ends up like the currency of the Weimar Republic. We have to keep the presses running all the time.
Yeah.
Create more currency, so there'll be enough money to keep the system running.
Yeah. The thing is, the Fed, from what I understand, this is something we discussed last week, when it opened its discount window to these five major banks, these big insider banks, if I understand correctly what's happened, it's told them there is no binding requirement regarding the reserves they have to have on hand in order to issue new loans. They can just use this money to issue as many loans in any amount as they see fit.
Well, I think that we're in real trouble. We would be in real trouble, but adding on top of that the possibility of a war with Iran is organized madness. Let's get your webpage out.
www.rightsourceonline.com.
One more time.
rightsourceonline.com.
And, of course, what is the subplace there where your blog is?
Yes, it's on the left-hand side of the page.
All right, fine. We'll be back in just a moment here.
Yeah, the idea that these banks got the first use of this newly created fiat money, whether you're talking about freshly printed Federal Reserve notes or what's more likely just digital transfers by the click of a mouse where a fresh increment of zeros was added to their bank account. The fact that they've been told that the reserve requirements have been waived, which is something I believe was made possible by legislation in the early 1980s. What that says is we can expect a huge outpouring of inflationary fiat money from the Fed in order to cover the loans that are going to be issued by these banks. And, of course, in the last couple of days, we've seen where the Federal Home Administration, the FHA, which is the New Deal era an entity that was created way back in 1934 for the purpose, I believe it was 1934, for the purpose of subsidizing home ownership. You know, that's what got us into this mess to begin with. They're, of course, going to be involved in bailing out people who've taken out these subprime mortgages and can't make their payments as the interest rates rise and their payment burdens expand. And then Bush today was talking about a plan involving FHA and I believe also Freddie Mac, if I remember correctly, to be taking a more active role in bailing out the mortgage lenders. So we're seeing where the pump is being primed here for a major bailout, and there are trillions of dollars tied up in mortgages of all kinds. Nobody knows how to trace the bad mortgage loans. They've been sold and resold. They've been folded and refolded into debt instruments that have been circulated as bonds and securities. It really is a combination of a Ponzi scheme and a three-card Monte operation with elements of the find the pea under the cup scam. Nobody knows. Nobody knows where the bad loans are. I mean, the bad loans have been mixed into this system the way that strychnine can be mixed into loaves of bread. You know, you don't want to eat any of the loaves because all of them are poison and some of them are fatally poisoned. And so when they're talking about bailing out the lenders and the debtors here, you're going to have a potential bailout that would dwarf the SNL scandal of the 1980s by probably a couple of orders of magnitude. And in order to do this, they're going to have to let the printing presses or the digital equivalent run. Helicopter Ben Bernanke, the one who talked about preventing a depression by dropping bales of money out of helicopters, which is, by the way, something they tried over in Iraq. I mean, they literally were kicking bales of freshly issued Federal Reserve notes.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there because we're just about out of time.
Okay.
Hang on for just 30 seconds and we'll wrap this up. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here with William Gregg, and always a pleasure to have William with us. But I think he shares my concern that we are doing everything wrong from a financial point of view. I mean, we should, if there was any hope of saving our currency, we should be simply letting a lot of people go bankrupt and then cutting back on the availability of funds and raising the interest rates. And this is what Paul Volcker did in 1980, and he saved the dollar. But we're not doing that. And they're talking about going to war with Iran. They're talking about bailing out everybody who got a bad loan. And this will end up destroying the value of your currency. If you destroy the stability of a currency, you destroy the stability of a nation.
Yeah. And if that doesn't serve to destroy our economy, then the oil price shock from a war with Iran would do that with interest.
Amen to that. Well, thank you so very much for being with us, Bill. Really look forward to having you with us next
time. Thank you so much, Dr. Stan.
And these are exciting times, aren't they?
Yeah, I wish they were a little less stimulating.
Bye-bye. Good night. God bless.
You too.
All right, fine. Well, that was William Gregg. Really, it's such a pleasure having him, and we're going to have try to have him on with us on a regular basis. One of the certainly most insightful people I know out there with a tremendous grasp of what's going on. Go to his website at rightsource.com, rightsource.com, and go look on the left side of the page. You'll see his blog there. Get his information. Follow it along. It's well worthwhile. Well, this is the time I simply would want to suggest, if you really want to go know what's going on, why, of course, we have a four-tape set on concentration camps. We have a four-tape set and a number of videos on concentration camps. We call that the Concentration Camp Special. We actually have, and we've printed up copies of the official government regulations for dealing with labor, civilian labor, in military camps. This is civilian prison labor. Everything is in place. We have a great four-tape set on the impending police state. The impending police state that it certainly goes into all this legislation that's been passed in recent years, preparing us for a dictatorship in what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, what it's here, well, you'll have no comeback at all. And this is what's always happened to nations that have turned their back on God, and God has brought his judgment on that nation. If you'd like to know how we have financed communism since its inception, the book Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution and The Best Enemy Money Could Buy, let me suggest my interview with Professor Sutton back in 1980. It's also called The Best Enemy Money Could Buy. To understand how, of course, we're controlling nations throughout the world, and we do have an empire. America has troops stationed in 130 nations, over 700 military bases throughout the world. The book, The Secret History of the American Empire. The Secret History of the American Empire. And then, of course, by the same author, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set of my interviews with John Perkins, and that is called Economic Hitman. And you'll never find anything quite like that. Mr. Perkins was part of a secret intelligence movement intent upon getting other countries into debt, and that, of course, enslaving the people there, which is why almost half the population of the world lives on $2 a day or less. Half the population of the world lives at $2 a day or less. 50,000 children die every day of starvation throughout the world, while we live so comfortably. Ladies and gentlemen become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And there is evil in the world, organized evil, on a degree heretofore unknown. You need, of course, to get my talk, Brotherhood of Darkness, my talk on the Forbidden Secret, the video on the secret mysteries of America's beginning, and of course on the riddles in stone. If you'd like more information, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for this next hour, they're going to be the views of Dr. Carrie Savage, who's a specialist in infectious disease and internal medicine from Southern California. And, of course, we were intimately involved. He was with the battle to try to stop the further and unnecessary spread of HIV disease, so-called AIDS, in this country. And when I left, Dr. Savage and a small group of people persisted, and they did get some of the legislation enacted, which was needed to stop the spread of the disease. Of course, nothing's really happened because they're not doing the contact tracing and the other public health work that are required by the laws that have been enacted. But because I had decided, well, when I got out of this back in 1996, that they had no intention of stopping the AIDS epidemic, which is why I started doing talk radio, which I'm doing and I've been doing since 1994. But Dr. Savage has continued there, and I applaud him for it. But he contacted me the other day about another problem. And as he said, I never thought I would get involved in another crusade. And then he told me the amazing story you are going to hear tonight. So without further ado, Dr. Carrie Savage, can you explain to our listeners what this is really all about?
Stan, first of all, thank you for having me. This is pretty much about how our legal system is causing our nation to collapse, both emotionally, spiritually, and in this circumstance, certainly economically. And this deals with a hospital that I worked at for 27 years. I'm not a disgruntled physician, but what I've witnessed in this particular incident is the most reckless act I have ever seen in my medical career by any healthcare institution. And I'll explain this to your listeners, but I just wanted to stand just for one moment on the issue of HIV. I think that, I don't know how much your listeners really know, but the work that you put into this, you planted the seeds, 20 years ago when this epidemic, we were first learning about the cause of HIV and it was exploding in this country and subsequently around the world. And you planted the seeds that were very simple, but they were the thing that needed to be done. All you asked for was that HIV be treated and get due, that it's a deadly epidemic that's killed now tens of millions of people around the world. And all you were asking for was basic, simple public health, to enact the measures in public health that would be compassionate, that could then save lives by stopping the spread of the disease. And as you know, this was a political issue rather than a health issue, and it finally took this year for the governor to sign a bill in California just to allow us to report HIV by name to public health services in a confidential way so that there could at least be some attempts at partner notification and contact tracing. So after over two decades of watching this disease, spread like wildfire throughout our population, it took this long to allow us to at least notify the health department of who's infected. So I just wanted to personally thank you for planting those early seeds. This should have been something that should have been done, as you know, decades ago, but it took this long. And now we've got to make sure that at least partner notification is implemented. But once again, Stan, I want to thank you for that. And then we can now talk about this new problem, which is a disaster in this nation, which is all of the litigation we're seeing over this black fungus or black mold, which is known as stachybotrys.
All right, Brian, could you pronounce that again for our listeners?
Stachybotrys, it's S-T-A-C-H-Y-B-O-T-R-Y-S.
All right, and we're going to be talking about that for this hour. It's an amazing story.
B-O-T-Y-R-S. I might have misspelled it myself. This is actually a plant fungus a plant pathogen. It's not a significant human pathogen by any means. And so, you know, I'm an infectious disease specialist. Neither myself nor any of my colleagues have actually ever seen anybody infected with this particular fungus.
And in fact, this is the black mold that you see on lumber that you see in the lumber yard. That black coloring that's on lumber, it's innocuous, doesn't do any harm, gets a little wet, gets a little moldy, and of course once it dries out, it doesn't tend to spread at all. So you pick this story up and go from there.
Yeah, in fact, go to any winery, go down into the cellars, and all the French oak are covered with Stachybotrys on the walls of the caves and the wine cellars, and this is considered to be appropriate for a winery. And when you're down there with no ventilation, you're inhaling potentially billions more spores than the situation that we've seen at our hospital. And what happened was, this is a hospital that was built in 1992, and it was occupied, starting occupation 92, 93, and 94. And over the last 15 years, there has never been a single case of anybody known to be infected or having any adverse health effect relating to Stachybotrys. But what happened was there were some leaky windows. And this is how you get, one of the ways you get fungus, is that this fungus loves humidity and moisture, and when the drywall gets wet, you get Stachybotrys, which is the black mold fungus. But what's interesting is that probably 85% of all structures, including the hotel that I'm in right now, the house you're in right now, and the homes that your listeners are in right now, 85% of them have Stachybotrys. This hospital, they spent millions of dollars doing mold counts in the air, but they never disclosed what the mold counts were. They never said that the mold counts are higher in this building than in any other hospital or any other building in the geographic area. Nobody's ever actually seen the mold. No, in 15 years, none of the tens of thousands of us who work there, nor the 400,000 patients that have been through that hospital in 15 years, have ever reported any health issue. The hospital themselves stated, we do not have a health problem. We have the perception of a problem. Not one time did they ever state that they have more Stachybotrys or any other fungus in that building than anywhere else. A consequence of this, there was a ton of litigation. The initial contractor, 19 subcontractors, anybody that touched that building was sucked into a lawsuit. And so now you had everybody pointing fingers, like, oh, I decided what color paint, or I decided this. But basically, multiple subcontractors, and then it was remediated, the hospital, and the remediator who involved in the fixing of the hospital was also sued.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, Gary, and we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Kerry was saying that this hospital he works in, built in the early 1990s, and certainly there has never been any report of anybody injured by the Stachybotrys black mold. They can't find the black mold. They've checked the air, and they can't find any, at least they won't tell anybody whether there's actually an increased number of spores in the air. But there is perception of a problem. In other words, there might be a problem. People are concerned about the possibility of a problem because they keep talking about the problem and talking about the problem and talking about the problem. And as a result, of course, the people who built the building, the people who designed the building, the people who have done work on the building, they've all gotten sued because there is a perception there might be a problem for Stachybotrys does not harm human beings. And there's no incident that Dr. Kerry Savage, who's a very knowledgeable infectious disease specialist, no incidents in humans he's ever been able to find of anybody being harmed by this black mold. And yet, literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of lawsuits have been generated for a non-problem. So pick the story up there, Kerry.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, there are some real environmental problems in our country. Our roads are in the worst shape they've ever been in. Our bridges are collapsing like you've seen. We have no way to dispose of toxic nuclear waste. And yet, in this particular building, the legal fees up to this moment, since this all started, and the remediation for doing many things that were not needed, is upwards now, I'm told, of $170 million. This is happening while we can't provide health care. Education's collapsing. Our environment has real issues that we can't deal with. This is a plant pathogen. The amazing thing is there's no litigation in Greece, in Turkey, in Japan, in Canada, in Mexico, or any other country. This is a unique industry that's exploded in this country over suing over a non-human pathogen. Now, the building, I'm sure, has some Staphylococcus, just like the other hospitals I work at have Staphylococcus, because anytime there's ever been water leaks, or as you pointed out, sometimes lumber already comes in with the black fungus on it. It's in soil. It's ubiquitous. It's been around for 400 million years. It's been in this country and every other country on this planet from the beginning of time. And yet, now we have a unique industry that's exploded over this. It's one more thing to sue over. And it's our country cannot afford to be spending billions of dollars shutting down hospitals, shutting down libraries, shutting down schools, shutting down government buildings. Ever since I got involved in this, I'm getting so many calls, people telling me their horror story about litigation over black mold. Lawyers are becoming extremely wealthy, but what the listener needs to know is insurance companies do not have printing presses. They get their money from us. So when we pay our homeowners insurance, this is paying for all of these settlements and all of the costs of litigation. And so this is being funded by all of us through our homeowners insurance. And, you know, I was talking with my wife the other day. You know, a year ago, we were paying something like $85 or $95 a month, or maybe about a year and a half ago. And now that's $185 for the same amount of coverage. So it gives you an idea of the extent of this. You can talk to home builders, contractors, and you ask them what's the biggest threat they have of just staying in business today. And it's not the high cost of lumber or the high cost of copper, which is high, or certainly insurance. Health insurance, which is affecting them dramatically. But their biggest problem now is litigation, and much of it is litigation over this black mold, which is not a significant, if any, pathogen at all. I mean, we were down in winery recently in these caves. There was no ventilation. We were down there for 2 hours. I was exposed, and my wife is exposed to more mold in those 2 hours than everybody walking through the doors of this hospital over 15 years multiplied by a trillion. And yet, so this hospital was shut down and gassed. Every winery should then be shut down permanently because it comes right back. And so, you know, this is the situation we're facing. Now, what's amazing in this particular case is the decision was made that the way they're going to get rid of the black mold is to fumigate the hospital with chlorine dioxide gas. They went ahead and spent millions of dollars tenting the building, shutting down the hospital, basically vacating it, removing millions of dollars, moving equipment in and out over 3 or 4 days. They had like 40 big-time trucks and did all this work. They didn't even have the permit yet, but they knew they could do it. When we spoke to the state pesticide controller, the California Health Department for pesticides, basically when they first heard about this, they called this political poop. You want to use the case. What then occurred, we just assumed that they would never allow this. Chlorine dioxide was not even approved in the state of California. The company doing it, Sabre Company, which is 50% owned by Rudy Giuliani, did not even have a license yet in California. These are the things we were told. And we just assumed that nobody in their right mind at the state level would risk their careers to allow this hospital to be shut down for absolutely no need of fumigation. And then basically approve of a gas that's not approved in California. And it went on and on. We found out that this company was, we were told, had done the Hart Building with anthrax in the Senate Hart Building in Washington, D.C. It turned out that they had a very minor engineering role. So many things were misrepresented. To make a long story short, they did get the approval to gas it. The state health department, the state pesticide regulators, despite telling us how insane this was, went ahead and approved it anyway. So we have no idea what level pressure might have been put on their pesticide regulators. This is what we're trying to discover right now. Meantime, the hospital gets shut down for 10 days, gets gassed, $24 million to do the gassing. It was absolutely unneeded. This gas is known to be explosive in high concentrations. It's known to be corrosive. And the amazing thing is now we want to know, okay, did you kill what you were supposed to kill? Now, they didn't disclose any of the air spore counts for the Staphylococcus, so we have no idea what was even there. When they gassed the building, they're now saying that, well, we really aren't going to check spore counts later, so we won't even have a comparison to know. They put in strips throughout the hospital of spores to see if anything was killed by the chlorine dioxide. But what they didn't do is put in spores of Staphylococcus. They put in bacterial spores of Bacillus species and Clostridial species. So they didn't even have the guts to put in the spores of the fungus they're supposedly wanting to kill. So now my question is, okay, you don't even know if you killed what's there. All the fungus that's supposedly there is behind the walls and the drywall. So now they're claiming they can't tell if it's killed or not because they can't get back there. It all goes, it's insane. They're not measuring the spores in the air to tell us. I want to know if the spore count's the same in 6 months. Are they going to shut the hospital down again, spend another $24 million, you know, affecting the physical plant of the hospital to accomplish nothing? Then the question is, well, why would anybody do something like this? I mean, this is the question I keep asking. It's so insane that it makes no sense, and it's hard to even discuss a situation like this when it's so absurd. Nobody believes. Why would a hospital do something like this? And I can tell you, I have spoken to everybody I can, including people at Catholic Healthcare West, which is in San Francisco. And the answer that I got, as best I can put it together, and I wish they'd correct me if I'm wrong, is that, well, we really didn't have a health problem. It's just the perception of a problem, and so we need to bury the perception. So how are they burying the perception? They're latching onto junk science and telling the public that they have a mold problem. What they have is mold, not a mold problem. But what they're not telling you is that this is all about litigation. The higher the settlement, the more, and the longer this dragged on, the more money the lawyers are getting. So now you've got a huge incentive for the lawyers to generate a huge settlement. So they've turned a fender bender of leaky windows into a basically hospital being totaled of over $170 million and still counting.
Well, I think the amazing thing is that
unbelievable.
What people don't understand is the lawyers make money on both sides. The
right.
Plaintiff's lawyers make money, the defense lawyers make money. And in fact, you know, if this weren't a problem, then the defense lawyers wouldn't have anything to defend against. So they're not interested in bringing out the truth. Certainly the plaintiff's lawyers, since there is no problem, they wouldn't want to bring out the truth. And you play this game, and you can destroy hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, wasted, and the only people who benefit are the lawyers, because there's no problem. This is the incredible thing.
Well, you know what's amazing? You're absolutely right, Stan. The defense lawyers want this to continue. The plaintiff lawyers want. They're all getting paid through insurance companies to do all this. But, you know, there are more guilty parties than I had any idea. I'll give you another guilty party. The people who do the remediation. Millions and millions of dollars are being spent doing remediation that isn't needed. So, you know, if there's mold there, oh, we'll fix the mold, even though it's not causing a problem. So you've got the remediators wanting to do this as well, because they're making money on it, paid through insurance companies. Many of the people in the industry of remediation I have spoken to, in fact, everyone I spoke to in the remediation field, was absolutely shocked that the chlorine dioxide would be allowed to be used in this circumstance. But what's amazing about it is some of the remediators, if their method was used, they would have probably let it pass as long as they can get paid for it. So you've got the remediators not being honest and saying, look, there's nothing broken here. It's like if you went to a physician and your knee was perfectly okay, but you bumped it the other day and they want to now replace your knee. And you say, wait a minute, you know, let me just let it, what's broken here? Not everything needs to be fixed surgically. Not everything needs to be remediated surgically either in terms of like a hospital building. So you've got the remediators on the take. You've got the lawyers on both sides on the take, but the worst part about this is that we've now identified this fungus, even though it's been here forever, that's really not causing any significant human disease. And it's in every building, or 85% of buildings, supposedly. Okay, now you've got the situation. I think the worst party here are the doctors and the toxicologists and the microbiologists, because they're then called into court. They're paid a ton of money to be expert witnesses, and they say, well, you know what? There's mold here, and one day it might be a problem. Well, it might be a problem. I mean, since it's not been a human pathogen all the decades it's been looked at, might mean 0.001, or does it mean 99? And the fact is...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, Carrie, go right ahead.
Okay. So the point is you've now got physician prostitutes, microbiology prostitutes, toxicology prostitutes. They just go to court. They say this might be a problem, or it may be a problem, or it's a potential problem. Instead of saying the chances of this causing a problem are so remote that you can't be fixing things that are just not broken. They use the word might, potential, may. Big time checks are paid. All their expenses are paid, and then they fly to another court, some other city, some other state. And you've got all of these physicians going around now making a fortune testifying and saying, you know, this might be a problem someday. That's all they have to say. They don't give any of the basic science to say that, wait a minute, there's more mold outside the building than inside the building. So if you want to fumigate, you should be fumigating the outside and tell everybody to come inside the building. I mean, in other words, they use no science, no clinical experience, no nothing. So the doctors who are prostituting around the country are making money on it. So this industry has exploded in America where everybody's on the take, and it's being paid for through insurance policies, which is basically you and me. So every time there's more litigation, the cost of insurance goes up. Maybe some contractors wind up not being able to be insured anymore because of this. So now you've got all this pressure on home builders, architects. Anybody that does anything to do with construction is named in the case now. So as an example, at this hospital, there were 19 subcontractors that were named. And then they're all pointing fingers at each other. Well, I had nothing to do with this, and then this one had nothing to do with it. The fact is nothing was really broken. And I spoke to somebody who actually went through this building and told me in no uncertain terms that this building had about the same amount of mold as any other building. Nothing needed to be remediated. And as far as the Stacia Boitras being there, her position was that the most likely cause was not even water through the windows. She said that most buildings, the way they do mopping, is that water is left on the floor in the corners and along the side wall coming into the floors. And that it's left there for a while, water then tends to drip down, and then it's mopped up. And she says this is probably the most common cause of getting any fungus into the drywall. And it's not a clinical problem. And in fact, if you really want to, you know, aerosolize the spores, then you remediate by tearing out the drywall and doing all of the reconstruction is probably what could aerosolize the spores. Otherwise, it's just sitting there on the drywall. You know, call it modern Japanese art. It's not causing a problem. It's in pretty much every building. Even if you tear out the drywall and do all this, it's going to come right back because, you know, there's water leaks and then this fungus lives in water. But it doesn't cause a problem. You know, and so this is what we're dealing with. So this means that we want to remediate 85% of all buildings and homes in this country. I mean, it absolutely makes no sense at all. And right now we're spending billions of dollars. This nation is economically a basket case as a country. And you know this, we owe every other country in the world money. We now owe Russia over $300 billion. I heard we now owe Mexico over $69 billion. This is all, China's like in the trillion range. Japan's in the trillion range. South Korea's $400 billion, not million. We owe so much money, and we are, and this is the country that's squandering the little money we have left, fixing nothing that's broken, while the rest of the world is making everything that we use, and we have to borrow money to buy the things that we use, and we're just going into deeper and deeper debt. And
hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Dr. Savage, Dr. Carrie Savage, is really pointing out the fact that this is a non-issue, and yet we're talking about literally billions of dollars in lawsuits. In fact, the lawyers make money if they're defense lawyers. The lawyers make money if they're plaintiff's lawyers. I saw in the Wall Street Journal the other day where one of the law firms was raising their rates for consultation to $1,000 an hour. $1,000 an hour, of course they bill by the hour. And the more hours they put in, the more $1,000 bills they're going to collect. But this is a non-issue. Nobody gains from this. But other than the lawyers and, of course, the physicians who come and testify prostitute themselves and the people who come in and certainly gas the buildings, like Mayor Giuliani's company coming into California to gas this building. What was it, 27 or 24 billion they put out?
The bill came to $24 million, just the gassing part. It shut down the hospital for 10 days. There were waiting, ambulances waiting at all the other hospitals to get patients seen. I mean, it put the neighborhood at risk, the community at risk. It overburdened, you know, the entire healthcare system of Ventura County. And it was all done, the decision to do this was made by lawyers, not by doctors, not by scientists. And the amazing thing is, you would think, in this insane experiment, that at least they'd want to learn something. And can you imagine, they put in bacterial spore strips throughout the hospital to see if they killed the bacterial spores. Why didn't they see if they killed the fungal spores? That's what supposedly they're looking for. So they can't measure the fungus in the walls. They have no intention to do spore counts in the air because they know they were never significant numbers to begin with. And now they didn't even put in strips of fungal spores to see if they killed the spores. I mean, it's like they didn't even want to learn anything. I mean, it's like if you're going to do an experiment that's not needed, at least learn something. Do some kind of control. I mean, absolutely no controls. There's no indication there was any more spore in that building than any other building. They did not plan on checking it later. They didn't say if they did check it later and they found no difference, would they gas it again? Are they going to check the other 51 Catholic Healthcare West hospitals to see if maybe they have higher spore counts because they're older and probably had more water leaks than this hospital?
Was there another?
There's no end to it. And the worst part, Stan, is they gassed only half. This building was the hospital and then the doctor offices and the pharmacy and all that. They decided that they would only gas half of it. It was built by the same contractors, the same period of time, the same windows, same construction, but they only do half of it. Like, as if there's an imaginary line where this fungus then stops. I mean, and the hospital itself acknowledges they didn't even have a problem. It was a perception. So now you've got a situation where a hospital is doing all this remediation that's not needed. Now, think about all the lawsuits that are pending or will be created in the future. They just point to this hospital and say, they fixed their mold, we want our mold fixed. So now what they've done is not only did they latch on to junk science, but they're now disseminating this junk science, so now this will become the gold standard. So this is going to make it easier for more litigation around the country. I mean, if a hospital's willing to do this, then we want our home fixed, or we want our building fixed. And so this is maybe going to make this problem in America far worse. So we're just basically collapsing under the weight of lawyers and litigation and doing nothing constructive anymore in this country. And we all know that there are lots of things that need to be fixed, but there's no money left to fix it.
And, of course, it really seems so incredible that they would do this, and yet sometimes I think that we're, you know, just living in a world gone mad, and other times I'm absolutely convinced we're living in a world gone mad. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment on this, and I don't know if you've heard about this, but apparently since Dr. Savage has gotten involved, he's getting calls from all over the country, people involved in lawsuits because of this non-problem. Now, of course, there are many very real problems, very many real medical problems that we should be addressing, and yet what are we doing? Well, we're focusing everybody's attention on a non-existent problem. We're spending literally hundreds of millions and pretty soon billions of dollars to fix a non-existent program. And I was amazed. I thought I knew just about everything going on today, until Dr. Savage called me, and I'd never heard of the scourge of the black mold. And of course, how this is really being used, and it would be really humorous if it weren't so tragic. Well, if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, Carrie, of course, as you actually have been bringing this up, and I'm sure you've talked to the members of the staff, what's the attitude of the hospital towards you? Are they angry at you? Are you the troublemaker? Because certainly when you speak out and try to dramatize and reveal what's going on immediately, why people usually get very angry with you, very defensive, and after all, you are a threat to them.
I've worked at this hospital for 27 years. I've had no disciplinary problem. I'm not a disgruntled doctor. I love the hospital. I probably spent more time there than I have in my own home. So from that perspective, there's I don't see any problem at all. And their response to me is, well, he just has a difference of opinion. But privately, I can't tell you how many people who work there have said, you're absolutely right. Thank you for speaking out. I wrote an article, Stan, in the Ventura County Star. If anybody wants to read it, they can just Google Ventura County Star, Savitch, S-A-V-I-T-C-H, Legalitis, L-E-G-A-L-I-T-I-S. That's how I kind of titled it. So, and July 29th. So if you Google July 29, Ventura County Star, Savitch, Mold, Legalitis, you can go to the article and read about it. I tell the hospital that I'm their best friend. I mean, I'm speaking out on their behalf. Anybody who, when your child or your friend or your hospital, whatever you want to say, is doing something that's wrong, then you need to speak out. And there are a lot of things in life that we all see that are not right. And we sometimes walk by them because they may not seem big enough and you can't fix and deal with each problem. But this thing was so outrageous and so reckless that for me not to speak out would have been wrong for the hospital. And so I needed to speak out. And I stood up at a medical staff meeting and I said that I wanted to go on public record that despite working here for 27 years and having no problem, I want to go on record to say that this is the most reckless thing I have ever seen any institution do, and it's being done for legal reasons and generating a huge settlement and not being done for any health issue, and it's putting the community at risk, and it's creating a problem in terms of the latching on to junk science. And if they want to fix a perception of a problem, you fix it with good education. You fix it by telling the public exactly what the issue is instead of creating a problem. So the perception, I believe, was created by the hospital, by them going through all this remediation that doesn't need to be done. And it's being done in the most reckless way by not even saying this is what's wrong, and this is the mold count or the spore count.
Yeah, hold
and we're going to check it later to see if we fix it.
Right there,
none of these things have been done.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Carrie Savitch, and we're talking about the scourge of the black mold. And right now, let's go to Michael, who's calling in from Riverside. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Thanks, Dr. Savitch, for bringing this issue up. Let me ask you, have you ever heard of Dr. Robert Bonham out of Texas?
I've been reviewing everything I could find on the Internet, and I know there's been a lot of litigation with black mold in Texas.
Yeah.
But the specific name, I'm not that familiar with.
Well, I, at one time, this is going back several years now, I was a waterproofing specialist at a company.
Uh-huh.
And we dealt with the issue of the mold quite a bit. And I did a newsletter for them. In fact, I got the newsletter on Dr. Bonham sitting right in front of me here. And he, as you may know, out of Texas, they are really the ground zero for this. About 70% of the lawsuits nationally are in Texas. I think about the rest of the 30% are probably in California. Those are the only two states that are really hit hard by this. Dr. Bonham concluded, he's an otolaryngologist, and he concluded that the mold is indeed not harmful at all. There's many other pathogens in the air and irritants that are much more harmful than mold. He went and reviewed 465 studies on diseases linked to mold and found that this confirmed everything that he had learned from his work. Well, eventually, he decided the only way to stop this in Texas before it ruined the entire state was to get into legislation. He's pretty politically active anyway. So they went to a former Texas Attorney General, and he helped him to put together some legislation, which they eventually passed. And I'll try to sum it up very, very briefly, that what it does is, it based on the science, there is no problem with the mold. It's just that certain people, and it's a fairly narrow band of people, have allergic and other reactions to it. But they, in the legislation, they take the position that this is the problem of the individual. If you have weak immune responses, that's not the problem of the whole state. It's just something that needs to be dealt with you.
Would you do me a favor? I think that's very important information, because I'm even learning about this. Now, I had no idea the extent of all the lawsuits and how damaging this has been. Email is stophiv@aol.com.
Okay.
If you wouldn't mind emailing me, we can communicate, and I'm so glad you shared this with Stan's listeners.
Yeah, and I'll do that, but let me also give you one that also the listeners can take a look at. And this is the website that they actually put together, two organizations under Dr. Bonham in Texas, and they have a website which is sensiblemoldpolicy.org.
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 Okay. Thanks very much, Michael. I really appreciate your call.
Let me share this with the listeners, too. There were two cases in Cleveland of children who developed what's called pulmonary hemosiderosis. It's a very rare thing where blood gets into the lungs. And they didn't know what caused this, because these are two kids that lived in a similar area. The Centers for Disease Control got involved, and it was mention made that there was black mold in the house. But this is where there's tons of black mold in every house, okay? They didn't state that the black mold caused these two children to develop the pulmonary hemosiderosis. And they came out with a statement later. Their position on this was that it did not cause these children to become ill. There were no other cases of this, yet all the lawyers latched on to these two kids and said, look what it did to these two kids. And so now multiple websites have sprung up about black mold causing these two children to have pulmonary hemosiderosis, even though there was no association. The CDC has come out stating that it's not connected to that. And there have not been other cases of problems associated with it in terms of any direct infection. Now, the Institute of Medicine, the Centers for Disease Control, the American Academy of Allergy and Immunology, the American Academy of Occupational Health, have all come out with position statements stating what your caller just said, that this is not a significant human pathogen in any way. And even if it, let's say the worst case scenario, that there are some cases of it causing disease that we don't know about, can we afford as a nation to tear down 85% of all buildings just because somebody sees some mold somewhere? Can we afford to shut down all wineries, shut down all lumber yards? I mean, it's like, if it is a pathogen, it's so minor. Hello?
Yeah, go right ahead.
So the point, Stan, is that, you know, the four institutions have all come out with positions stating that this is not a significant pathogen. In reviewing the literature, the last reported problems with this were horses that ingested large amounts of spores in Siberia in the 1930s and became ill, and some horses died. This was by ingesting the spores in huge amounts of spores that grew under, like in the snow conditions, under some of the oats. Now, I mean, the amazing thing here is that it need to ingest the spores, because there is a neurotoxin that the spore actually has, which can cause illness. But you don't get sick by spores sitting on a wall and you're not breathing anything. These spores are also in soil and everywhere else. So, you know, because these horses died in Siberia in the 1930s. I mean, that's how far you have to go looking to see if this you know, particular fungus can cause any problems. So it's a very, very, very insignificant pathogen to mammals, period.
All right.
And yet, you know, the lawyers have latched onto this. You know, they've gone from, you know, the silicon to from one thing after another, you know, and so now this is the new thing. And so many lawyers are making many millions of dollars on this. And there's no doubt that what our local hospital did is only going
to
make this problem worse.
I mean,
because people can now point and say, well, a hospital even fixed it. So what the hospital says is we've got a mold problem. The fact is what they have is mold. And what they have is, and everybody who works at that hospital has mold in their own homes. There's mold everywhere. This is normal. We couldn't live, we couldn't survive on this planet if we didn't have bacteria and fungi breaking down all of our, you know, waste products. So, I mean, we need to be thankful. Now, there are some funguses that are really problems, as you know, and kill. If you have candida on a heart valve, that's not good. Or if you have cryptococcus or cocci in your brain, that's not good. But this is not one of the funguses that cause a problem.
Okay. Well, let's go to Herman calling from Carmel, and then we've got to Mike in Santa Cruz. And again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Herman, did you have a question for our guest?
Well, I'd like to ask the listeners if they remember the case of the spotted owl. Years ago, that came up, and our whole lumber industry on the West Coast was shut down because supposedly the spotted owl was being wiped out. And they found out later it was not true, but the perception was there, and just like with this case, junk science, it accomplished its purpose. But I'd like to point out that most people probably, if you go to your kitchen, open your sink, the door under your sink, you may have some mold. Is this the same type of mold, the black mold that we're talking about?
Herman, yes, it is. In fact, I can share a story with you. One of the phone calls that I got was from somebody who shared with me that a lady committed suicide. The parents of this lady are now suing the owner of the apartment she lived in because they found some mold in the bathroom. Now, we may all think, well, this is absolutely insane and ridiculous. It still generates all of the litigation and all of the stress and trauma that's associated with this. So the answer is yes, that is the black mold. And it's basically, it's there. It's everywhere. You know, we've had 4 water leaks in our home over the last 7 years. They were all minor. There's nothing that caused us any problems. I'm not ripping out the drywall in my son's room. I'm not ripping out the drywall in our living room. I mean, these things just happened. They dried, and there's probably some black fungus in the drywall that I'm not looking for because it's not causing a problem.
Oh,
but we're facing an issue now where you sell somebody a house, and even though you disclosed whatever, there was no problem, they're going to turn around and say, you know what, we saw this black mold here, and we didn't know about this, and this has probably been here for years, and now my son has gastrointestinal problems or asthma or whatever, and they're going to then blame it on that, and you're going to be involved in a lawsuit. So now lawsuits are springing up all over the place over this. I was recently told that because of the insurance premiums going sky high, that some of the insurance carriers are no longer covering for this, and if they did, they would all be out of business. So if they're not covering for it, you can't buy insurance, but you can still be sued. So now everybody that sells a home can worry the rest of their life that they're going to be sued by somebody down the road because some black mold was not disclosed, even though it wasn't causing a problem.
Okay.
What's amazing, in no other country in the world is this going. If this is a real problem, then why aren't everybody suing each other in Italy or Japan or China or anywhere else? This is a unique problem in the United States because of our litigious, frivolous litigious behavior. And it's so destructive. It's a cancer. The litigation's a cancer. But as far as the black fungus, it's not. The only pest that St. John's Hospital has is me, because I'm speaking out on this.
Anything else, Herman?
Well, I can add personally that I know someone who was preparing a home for sale in this area. They did discover mold in the kitchen, and it was a lady, actually, that owned the home. She went down to the hardware store. She researched it, got some TSP, and then had the workmen repaint the area, clean it really well, and it took care of the problem. Now, I'm sure that could have been done in your hospital, but that wouldn't have satisfied the lawyers.
Yeah, I mean, not,
exactly right.
And
what we had was a fender bender that they turned into the hospital being totaled.
Thanks very much, Herman. Let's go to Mike calling from Santa Cruz. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Hi, Mike. Did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, question, Stan. Have they gone after the lumber industry at all yet? And I'm asking because, you know, when you go in the lumber yard and start going through the stacks, you find black mold everywhere. It's been there for years. It's never affected me any. But have they gone after the industry? They could shut down the housing industry is what I'm after if they wanted to, it seems.
Yeah. That's an excellent question, Mike. And I've got to tell you that at least in the hospital that I'm referring to, there were 19 subcontractors that were sued. They're blaming it on the water leak, so they didn't blame it on the original materials that were used. But you're absolutely right. I mean, that's the next target. So we're not going to have people in the construction industry, and we're not going to have lumber. So we're basically shutting down the our country.
Well, maybe these mold people would like to go over to Iraq and clean the depleted uranium out of the sand or something like that.
Well, I think there are lots more important issues than the black mold, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're now, you know, if any lawyer's listening, I'm sure they're going to figure out why didn't we go after the lumber yard, so they're next. And you know, any of us who go to a winery and then get sick years later, we can claim that, well, you know, we were at that winery and we were exposed to the mold on the French oak barrels, and nobody told us or warned us.
Well, you could have a good job as an expert witness testifying, you know, that this stuff does nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of physicians who are making a fortune just doing that. Why practice medicine when you can just go around and for a few hours and get paid tens of thousands of dollars to just say that this might be a problem someday? So... You're right, and there are doctor prostitutes.
Those lawyers will go running when they see you coming, then.
I won't do that, though.
Thanks very much, okay. Mike. And
hello?
When we actually had some black mold, because of water leak, my wife's just got a little Clorox and washed it off. That was the end of it. Once it got dry, it never came back again.
And if you want to really... aerosolize the spores, then start ripping out the walls, and that would probably cause the aerosolization. Otherwise, it's just like black paint behind your wall, causing no problem.
And of course, the problem is it gets right down to a matter of integrity. I'm sure the lawyers who are the defense lawyers know it's not a problem, but after all, if this whole issue were to stop, then of course they'd lose a lot of money. The plaintiff's lawyers know it's not a problem, but after all, of course, if they didn't take the suits, they wouldn't make a lot of money. Well, and that, of course, certainly the other people all involved, certainly, where are the government agencies when they're needed? All you need to do is have enough money. Why, you can buy any bureaucrat you want to. We have some of the finest bureaucrats money can buy, and if you don't think that money talks and when it comes to dealing with government, you're incredibly naive.
I think one of the issues here is how in the world did the state pesticide regulators allow this to happen? I spoke to them multiple times, and their response to me was, we only regulate the pesticide itself, and even though this isn't approved, if they can show need with a 24C permit that they need to do this route, then we have to approve it. They don't have to prove to us that they have a mold problem. So I asked them, I said, does this mean that if I had a sandwich and a spore fell off a piece of lettuce, that I can then call a friend from Michigan to come over and gas my house? You know, and the answer is pretty much yes. You know, they're not regulating if I'm allowed to do the gassing or the fumigation. All they're regulating is the particular pesticide. Nobody wants to take any responsibility here. So the pesticide people are in the business of permitting, not in the business of protecting. You know, I spoke with everybody I could reach at the state health department. And basically, it's like, that's not our field. There's nobody that does this. It's the hospital's business if they want to do this. It's like nobody seemed to care. And nobody really knew anything about Scotia Boitras. You'd think they'd at least want to know, since our state is spending so much money now litigating over this, they'd at least want to know something. I mean, and then the EPA. You know, I met the EPA people at the job site, and their response was, well, we're the state people. We're not the federal people, and we don't do anything unless we agree with what's being done. So I said, okay, so who agrees with this at the EPA level? Well, we don't know who agrees with it, and we're only here to monitor. I said, well, if you're here to monitor, then don't you want to know if the gas is at least going to kill the fungus and what the fungal count is to begin with? I mean, now we've got the EPA tied up in this. and basically absolute incompetency and lack of caring. You would think they would see what I'm seeing and say, wait a minute, why is this being done? They didn't even ask why. And so then we're wondering who at a higher level could be allowing this to happen. Is this some kind of experiment through Homeland Security, federal EPA? And nobody will answer our calls. Just the simple things about why was this done? What's the science behind it? It's like, you know, if our government is there and they're not protecting us because they're afraid to do anything, it's like we're in trouble. Our nation is so broken if something as reckless as this could happen and nobody cares.
All right, you hang on. We'll be back in just a minute. My guest has been Dr. Kerry Savitz, and his webpage would be beyondaids.org. That's beyondaids.org. His email, stophiv@AOL.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and again, the Dr. Savitz's website, beyond, www, of course, beyondaids.org. That's beyondaids.org. His email is stophiv@AOL.com. stophiv@AOL.com, but it'll get to Dr. Savitz. He's still working on the AIDS issue. And do you have anything on your website on the black mold on the at the Beyond AIDS website?
That website, Stan. I work with Beyond AIDS as an organization, and it's an educational organization trying to make people aware of HIV in terms of problem and what we need to do in terms of fixing public health. So I haven't really put anything on, you know, Satya Boitras on that website. I think it would confuse people. And maybe I will set up a website with Satya Boitras at some time in the near future. This has just, like, sprung up over the last few months. But at StopHIV@AOL, anybody who wants to contact me, and some of your callers had such interesting and informative things to say that I would appreciate if they could contact me as well.
All right. Well, certainly, I mean, this is something I think most people are relatively uninformed about. I know I certainly wasn't aware that this was even a problem until you called the other day till we talked, and then, of course, we had the chance to look into it a little bit, but apparently...
Man, I was uninformed. I'm an infectious disease doc, and I was uninformed because, you know, I've never seen a case of Satya Boitras, so none of us really discussed this. And then when this happened at our hospital... Then I started looking into this because I was asking questions like, what's broken here? What's the health issue here? What's this going to cost to fix something that's not broken? And in my own investigation, then I hear about all the litigation happening in Louisiana, in Texas, in other states, in California, and all the buildings that have been closed down already, all the money spent. So, I mean, I am just as guilty of being uninformed, and this is my field. I didn't know that all this litigation was going on and how costly it was and the detriment this was having to home builders, what this having to architects, and maybe it'll be to lumber yards next. So,
well, I appreciate what you're doing, Kerry, and certainly if we can help you at all, we'd be glad to get you on to our other programs. We've done some other interviews with Dr. Savitz, and they'll be broadcast on our weekend program all across America, trying to make people aware of this very real problem. And Kerry was kind enough to miss the end of a theater program this evening to be on with us. Thank you so much for being here, and give my best to your wife. Tell her I appreciate your letting her go.
Thank you, Stan.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our program with Dr. Kerry Savitz, a very, very courageous young man who is seeing something that just doesn't make sense. You know, I wanted to stop this because, of course, the implications, you know, of going after a non-problem and spending literally billions of dollars on something that is not a problem, while, of course, there are very real problems we're not addressing, like the AIDS epidemic. And so many other things, over in Iraq, they depleted uranium. You know, a third of the young men were coming home from Iraq now are ill within 3 months, according to the Gulf War. According to the Veterans Administration, almost 80,000 of the veterans of the first Gulf War are dead. These were young, healthy people. They were in their 20s. At that time, they'd be in their 30s, 35. Now, you do not lose that many people. Almost 10% of the population will be sent to the Gulf War unless there's something else going on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, of course, up there, lots of problems out there. We try to bring them before you, but behind everything going on, there are powerful spiritual forces, and when you see something and it just doesn't make sense, remember there is a reason. It may not be apparent to you, but behind everything going on in our country and throughout the world today, there are spiritual implications. And if you think things are, they look like they're mad for a long time, I looked at what was happening in the AIDS epidemic and I said, it doesn't make sense. If you haven't read my book, AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, you need to get it and read it. But then, of course, you need to get my material on population control, because that really explains why we were never allowed to try to stop the AIDS epidemic. And I hope if you'd like to get my talk on planned population reduction, it's available on DVD. My population control agenda monograph, available free up on our internet site at radioliberty.com. My talk on just on population control, available on video. And then, of course, our four-tape set on population control. You need to understand that there are people out there who have a different worldview. Perhaps to get some of the documents that they have written, you'll actually hold them in your hand if you get our syllabus on the hidden agenda and my talk that's really dealing, of course, with fluoridation, water fluoridation, but the same issues hold true with water fluoridation as with the AIDS epidemic, as with the autism epidemic, with this effort for mass population control, the use of aspartame in so many of our drugs, pardon me, so many of our foods, when it's known to be toxic. The use of mercury in the vaccines, and they're still putting mercury in children's vaccines, in vaccines that are given to children routinely at 6 months of age, knowing full well the damage it will do. If you've not yet seen the DVD we have by Dr. Ayoub called Autism, Mercury, and the Global Population Agenda, you need to get it. That's Mercury, Autism, and the Global Population Agenda, because, of course, you not only get the DVD, but you get a CD-ROM with literally thousands of pages of documentation going into the background of the terrible toxicity of mercury. And they know about it, and they know the harm that it's doing. They just don't want you to know. And then if you haven't seen Beyond Treason, it's the story of the depleted uranium that we're poisoning American servicemen with over in Iraq today. And that comes with a DVD with thousands of pages of government documents on this subject. Remember, of course, you can get all of the items by calling 1-800-544-8927. And then don't forget our conference on the 28th of October of this month, 28th of October, all-day-long conference, the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. Call 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like to know more. And then we ask you to pray for America, pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty.